We'll get a presentation on the feedback received on limited amendments to IFRS 9. I give the floor to Julia.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon. Just a very quick introduction. The ISB published its exposure draft, limited amendments to IFRS 9, on 28 November 2012, and the comment period ended 28th of March 2013. To date, we have received 167 comment letters, and we also conducted more than 40 formal outreach meetings, including meetings with preparers, users, regulators, and auditors. We have also conducted some joint outreach with FASB on their proposals. With that, and the outreach efforts are ongoing. With that, I turn over to Catherine, who will take you through the key messages we have received.
Okay. Thank you, Julia. As Julia mentioned, Agenda Paper 6A for this session summarizes the main points in the feedback from the ISB's exposure draft that propose limited amendments to the classification and measurement requirements of IFRS 9. For today's discussion, there are two main points to note. First, the staff will provide more detailed analysis of individual issues later on during redeliberations, as well as a summary of the outreach with investors. And second, today's discussion focuses just on the feedback received by the ISB on their exposure draft, and the FASB will present their feedback received at a future meeting. So for these reasons, we would like to keep today's discussion relatively high level and focused on the feedback received by the ISB. I'll structure the discussion by topic. So first, I'll introduce the feedback on the contractual cash flow characteristics assessment and open up the discussion to the boards, then move on after that discussion to the business model assessment, and then finally other issues such as fair value option, transition and effective date of IFRS 9. So with that, the first topic is the contractual cash flow characteristics assessment, which is contained in paragraphs 15 through 32 of the paper. If you read these paragraphs, you'll see that nearly all respondents agreed that a financial asset can have cash flows that are solely principal and interest, even if the economic relationship between the principal, time value of money, and credit risk is modified. So they supported the ISB's efforts to clarify this principle and noted that our proposals would result in more appropriate classification outcomes. However, many of them noted also that the proposals don't go far enough to clarify, and they also had a number of detailed questions and concerns on our clarifications. Specifically, many respondents commented on the scope of the modified economic relationship assessment, the threshold of not more than insignificant that was used in the exposure draft, and finally the proposed application guidance on this assessment. Generally speaking, many believe that the scope of the assessment should be wider, that the threshold for the difference in cash flow should be lower, and or that various aspects of the application guidance should be clarified. In addition to commenting on what was proposed and within the scope of the exposure draft, many respondents raised questions about other features of instruments, for example, de minimis embedded derivatives or contingent features. In addition to commenting on particular instruments and the proposals, many respondents raised broader questions or comments on the principle of solely principal and interest that's already in IFRS 9 and how to apply it. They requested clarifications of the principle, often in conjunction with requesting the clarifications for specific instruments, but a few of them thought that if we just clarified the principle more broadly, that the need to address particular instruments would go away. So finally, to give the boards a general idea of how this feedback from the ISB stakeholders could be addressed, we think that a lot of them could be addressed just by reemphasizing the principle we've got in IFRS 9, but also improving the application guidance. We also note that with the exception of just a few respondents who continue to favor bifurcation, most of our stakeholders continue to support the P&I principle that's in IFRS 9.
Yeah,
You're like Japanese now.
So with that, I'd like to open the floor to the board for discussion.
Pat.
Thank you, Catherine and Yulia. I'm curious, in terms of reemphasizing the principle, that part seems abundantly wise and makes complete sense to me. In terms of the scope of all the issues you've identified, for example, scope, threshold, application guidance, issues related to it, embedded derivatives, contingent features, specific instruments, it would be helpful to understand how you would go about improving the application guidance. Would it be with a view towards developing application guidance on each one of those topics? Or is there some other kind of approach that you think might make sense here? And the reason I raise it is because we just finished a discussion on another project where, you know, I think a good many of us believe that offering too much application guidance is not necessarily the way to go. So if you could hum a few more bars about how to approach this process. If you've given it some thought, if you haven't, I appreciate it.
I think we have given it some thought, Pat, but I'm a bit reticent for us to say too much, given it's a joint project and we haven't really agreed with the FASB how we address things. But I think just at a really high level, I think that we need to really clarify, I think we really need to make sure that we're all clear what we're trying to aim for in terms of outcomes. Were we trying to get to a sort of similar outcome of identifying things that are more like what we might think of as an embedded derivative today? Or were we trying to do something that's much more sort of conceptually pure? And I think that's the first sort of fundamental point that both boards will need to consider in the re-deliberations, based on what I've heard so far of the FASB's feedback as well. But I think it's a bit premature to say more than that before we're sort of on the same page.
I would agree with you, because I think if we do that, in some of the discussions we've had, and if we emphasize what we thought the outcome should be and the rationale behind the application of the principle, I actually think the need for extensive application guidance comes down. You don't need an example for every scenario that somebody's raised if you, in fact, go along that. Okay, thanks.
I'd like to ask Stas a sentiment about this question of embedded derivatives. I think that many people continue to ask for it in principle because they have been asking for it since the very beginning. But if we deal with the application guidance on the cash flow in a proper way, would that diminish, reduce the pressure on the bifurcation of derivatives? Would that alleviate a little bit the demands?
So you mean, would that reduce the request for bifurcation?
Well, I suppose the feedback that we have received on embedded derivatives falls broadly into two buckets. There are some constituents who raised questions about the effect of de minimis embedded derivatives on classification, which is one topic, whereas other constituents, but very few, continue to advocate bifurcation along the lines that it exists today. And it's not necessarily, when I say along the lines it exists today, it's not necessarily based on closely related criteria, but potentially based on a condition which is more aligned with P&I principle and maybe looking at the business model, but still this request is broader than just de minimis embedded derivatives.
I think Philippe's asking a slightly different question. I think he's asking, for the few people who remain that are asking for bifurcation, do we think their issues could be addressed by clarifying the principle and interest criteria, I think is what Philippe is asking.
My feeling that there is a tension point which is moving from SPPI test to bifurcation.
Yeah.
If we give a little bit more principle-based approach and the application guidance makes it that some normal plain vanilla lending can be classified at amortized cost, then the request for bifurcation of derivatives might go away. But if we say no, then it puts a pressure on the bifurcation, because people will want to put some of that by bifurcating the derivative back into amortized cost. So do you share this feeling that I have?
Yeah, I'd agree with that assessment from what I can see. I think that those who are the small minority who still favour bifurcation, I think of that's a lot driven by the fact that they don't think it's appropriate to end up at fair value through P&L given some of the features that are tipping them there. So I think that if we were to clarify principal and interest in a way that they felt more fairly reflected what a vanilla instrument was, I think we could address most of the remaining requests for bifurcation from an ISB perspective.
Any other comments? Are there any questions from the FASB members?
Any comments? No, it's all quiet over here.
Okay. We go on to the all next right. subject.
Okay, so then the next topic is the business model assessment, which is discussed in paragraphs 33 through 55 in the paper. The responses and the comments on the business model were largely focused on the proposal to introduce fair value through OCI measurement category, also on the proposed amendments to the application guidance for the business model assessment. So as you'll note in the paper, a majority of the respondents agreed with measuring some debt instruments at fair value through OCI, and responses were split even between, further than that, between three broad views relatively evenly. The first group was the group that supported fair value OCI as proposed in the ED. The second group agreed in principle with measuring some debt instruments at fair value through other comprehensive income, but they suggest something different as compared to the ED. And the third group disagreed with the introduction of a third measurement category into IFRS 9. Some respondents who agreed in principle with fair value OCI suggested or recommended things like fair value OCI being a residual category or a fair value through OCI option for some debt instruments or an unrestricted fair value through OCI category, which would be available just to avoid accounting mismatches. Many respondents commented that the proposed application guidance placed too much emphasis on the level or amount of sales that were occurring out of a group of financial assets rather than the reason for the sales, and that this emphasis would unduly narrow the scope of the held to collect or amortized cost category. Some also commented that the boundaries between the three categories were not clear enough, and they were questioning, for example, whether there was a level of sales which would tip a business model out of fair value OCI and into fair value through P&L, or vice versa, out of fair value through P&L and into fair value OCI if there weren't enough sales, even though the assets in that business model were managed on a fair value basis. In addition, some also thought that sales which are required by regulators or which are made to address concerns about credit concentration risk should also be consistent with the hold-to-collect business model and therefore should not disqualify assets from being measured at amortized cost. Again, to give the boards a general idea of how this feedback might be addressed, the staff again think that much of it could be addressed by improving articulation and application guidance on the business model assessment. And that's all I have. If anyone has comments or questions.
Martin.
Was there, regarding the comments, also a regional split? When you said, okay, it's one third, one in favor, one maybe medium, one did not like it, but region-wise, was there a trend?
Yes, there were, I mean, there were regional trends as well as industry trends in the feedback. I would say that, broadly speaking, many banks supported the fair value through OCI category, and many insurers conditionally supported it, and corporates had some concerns, but might support it as long as it wasn't too complex. Now, with that as general background, regionally speaking, yeah, there were some themes. those in North America, for example, tended to support the fair value through OCI category. Those in Europe were split, with some people in Western Europe supporting fair value OCI as proposed, and some supporting it, you know, but something a bit different. For example, insurers and others didn't support it at all. And then in Asia, there was polarization as well, where some supported it and others didn't.
And I'm hearing a lot of this option. I mean, many people say, okay, they like it. Also, insurers, I think they have support of this fair value OCI, but I think some also saying, also some in Germany saying, it's not far enough. They want to have an addition then this option, because they fear really if this amortized cost is too fixed, that okay, that they have still accounting mismatches and they want to have then an addition to this fair value OCI, maybe mandatory and accounting mismatch option category. Is that quite often that, or is that only limited to some?
Wasn't that often? Yes, I mean, there were comments about optionality and ways in which the proposals could be tweaked in many regions, although the suggestions might be a bit different by exact country or industry as well.
Okay, my last question is, okay, and was it also many questions maybe, because I personally think, okay, maybe it is not so difficult to distinguish between the hold to collect and the fair value OCI, but I think personally it's more difficult to distinguish and to have a clear cuts between the fair value OCI and fair value P&L. Was that also raised by commenters?
Yes, we received a number of comments to that effect. A lot of people were particularly concerned about what does managed on a fair value basis mean.
And I think that's the reason why some have suggested that maybe fair value through P&L is better as a mandatory category, like in fair value OCI as a residual, because I think it might be easier to identify amortized cost in fair value P&L and have fair value OCI as a leftover.
Yeah. Thanks.
Stephen?
I know that there's a lot of reference to insurance in all of these comment letters. Obviously, there's a number of responses from insurers themselves, and they are more strongly in favor of OCI than the average. There's also reference to insurance by non-insurance respondents who say, well, we either do or don't support it, but we think you should go ahead because of insurance, because it provides a solution to insurance. But I do note that some of the insurers don't necessarily have fair value OCI as their first preference. So there's one European insurer here that I've got, which says that for the insurance industry, it would be preferable to define the measurement category for assets backing insurance contracts based on our asset liability management business, so a wider use of OCI. But then they go on to say we strongly support the introduction of fair value OCI, but it's clearly certainly part of the solution that they see. So given this interaction with insurance, my question is about redeliberations and the timing and how we're going to do it with insurance.
I think we plan to bring something, and we have to be careful because we haven't agreed with the FASB how we're going to do the redeliberations, but I guess our initial thinking in terms of insurance is that it probably warrants a separate analysis of whether we should do something specific with insurance. And obviously the timing of the insurance project with the classification and measurement project is particularly challenging. And I know that at least a couple of letters I read queried whether we should build a model that really doesn't have insurance in mind and then come along with some sort of overlay later on that might be insurance specific. And so I think some of those considerations will need to be brought to the board.
There were very few responses from users, but you've done outreach. And what is your preliminary conclusions of the users' view of this topic?
We're planning to bring the investor outreach paper next month.
Okay.
Because our outreach is ongoing.
Okay.
Catherine, going back to para 38 in your paper, and you said this one surprised me a little bit. Other respondents agreed in principle with the fair value through OCI as proposed but only on the condition that it would not result in a reduced number of financial assets that would qualify for amortized cost. Where is that coming from? I just didn't get that.
I was surprised.
In fact, it might increase the...
That's something we heard with Martin when we visited certain countries. Maybe I can give you my feeling. We understood that in the first interpretation of the conditions for the specification at amortized cost, certain may have made assumptions as to what would go to amortized cost, which would be challenged by the coexistence of the fair value OCI model together. And the perception, and Martin maybe can help me, is that now that there is this OCI model, what they thought could go to amortized cost could no longer and would fall to OCI, to fair value OCI. That certain banks have formed the view that is now challenged by the existence of three categories. And we tried to explain that no, the criteria for amortized cost have not changed at all. If you take the first IFRS 9 on what we have today, the same criteria. So we see no reason. We saw no reason why they would have this fear, but we still understood that there were some assumptions which could no longer hold true based on the draft.
But if anything, this will increase the amortized cost presentation in the income statement more.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's why I was surprised with that comment, but thank you for giving the color.
The problem is our balance sheet. The balance sheet and the fact that the fair value through OCI instead of amortized cost, you will have the fair value changes on the balance sheet, and there is no longer a prudential filter that takes it out, so any fair value change on the balance sheet will hit their capital, regulatory capital. So they want to have as much as possible at amortized cost. And they don't really care about the volatility in P&L. They care about equity and the capital.
That is exactly it. Jean-Gu?
Yes. The PKs and the Philips, actually, EFRAG surveyed this question whether amortized cost the number of the amortized cost to fair value OCI. So maybe we will check, you know, whether they got some result of that survey, you know, whether really there is some change in the classification, reclassification from AC to fair value OCI. That might get some concrete maybe information about this issue.
Any more questions now? Any questions in Norwalk?
No questions here.
Okay, so the last topics are kind of the other comments raised in the feedback. The first one that I'll tee up is the fair value option. Nearly everyone who commented on RED agreed that the existing fair value option for accounting mismatches in IFRS 9 should be extended to financial assets that would otherwise be required to be measured at fair value OCI. However, there were some who favored an unrestricted fair value option, either just for the debt instruments that would be at fair value OCI or for all financial assets in general. The unrestricted fair value option just for the debt instruments measured at fair value OCI would be consistent with what the FASB proposed in their proposals. In addition, another issue is the proposals for own credit. Nearly all of the respondents who commented on this issue supported the proposal to allow just those provisions to be applied early before IFRS 9 is completed. However, most asked the ISB to make the own credit requirements available before the completion of IFRS 9. Most of them suggested incorporating them into IS 39, although some thought that incorporating them into IFRS 9 2010 might also allow them to be available sooner. And one last point to mention, many respondents, although a question wasn't asked in the ED about this, they asked the ISB to confirm as soon as possible that the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9 would be deferred, especially given the lead time that they think will be needed to implement the proposals on expected credit losses. Those are the main other issues which I thought should be highlighted. So with that, We're happy to take comments.
Any questions? Comments? No? Okay, Leslie, I think that brings us to the end of this meeting, unless there are any questions over there.
Any questions here? Hans, there is just one more matter that I wanted to cover, and yes. That is to say farewell to our colleague, Kevin Steklosa, one of our assistant directors here. This is his last meeting with us after spending 15 years in various roles here on the FASB staff. He's going to be returning to industry. During his time here, he was very instrumental in making advancements in the reporting of numerous financial instruments topics, hedge accounting, and most recently leasing. Kevin oversaw the staff activities from our side on those, and I know worked closely with many members of your board and staff. So on behalf of all of us, I want to thank Kevin for his service over the last 15 years, and we want to wish you all the best in your future endeavors.
You just beat me to it. We also want to thank Kevin. We also want to thank Kevin for his great efforts in the last 50 years.